Hi, friends. Welcome to the By Faith podcast. I'm your host, Christine Hoover, and I am so glad you're here. Each week this season, I'm talking with a guest about how they're using their unique gifts and talents in their specific context and season of life. My prayer for you is that by listening, you'll be encouraged, challenged, and equipped to step out by faith using your particular gifts for God's glory. This episode is sponsored by The Good Book Company, publisher of Five Things to Pray for Your Kids, a book by Melissa Kruger, where she takes us back to the Bible to show us what God's will for children is, so that we can pray in line with that. She selects 21 key areas of spiritual growth and character development, and for each one, there are five short prayer prompts drawn straight from the Bible. For more information about Five Things to Pray for Your Kids, go to thegoodbook.com. Today, my guest on the show is Dr. Russell Moore. Dr. Moore is married to Maria, and together they have five boys. Dr. Moore is also the president of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission for the Southern Baptist Convention. You'll hear more about what he does in a moment. I personally think he is a brilliant man who consistently represents Christians well in the public sector, but also speaks to us as Christians, helping us to think through modern ethical concerns. Many people say he has a prophetic voice, so I wanted to ask him about this. We talked about the gift of prophecy, what it is, and how it's seen in the church today. He also shares lessons he's learned about how we can all navigate discouragement and criticism, and how we can know whether or not we're being faithful to what God has asked us to do. I'm so thankful for Dr. Moore and have personally benefited from his ministry, and I know you will too today through this conversation. So here, friends, is my conversation with Dr. Russell Moore. Thank you so much, Dr. Moore, for joining me today.
Oh, thanks for having me. Good to be with you.
We were really privileged to get to see you recently here in Charlottesville at the University of Virginia. You came and spoke.
I love Charlottesville and love UVA, so I'm always happy to be there.
Well, you represented us being Christians well.
Thank you.
To our university. And I had to tell you a funny story because a few days ago, my youngest son, who actually came with us that night to hear you, he sat and colored while you were speaking. And he and I were driving in the car the other day, and we were, for some reason, talking about if we had ever had a celebrity encounter. And I told him, you know, a few of my celebrity encounters. And I said, well, have you ever met a celebrity? And he said, Russell Moore. Oh, my goodness.
We have to find him a celebrity to meet.
Yeah, but I thought that was hilarious. But he was impressed with you. So. Well, I would love for you to, for those who don't know you who are listening, tell us a little bit about you and your role.
Well, my wife, Maria, and I have five sons that range from 17 to 7 as of yesterday. One of the youngest one's birthday was yesterday. We adopted the first two from a Russian orphanage when they were just at a year old. And so that's been a big part of our lives. I serve right now as president of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, which really exists to do two things. One of them is to equip churches and families and Christians to think through ethical questions about what does the Bible teach? What does it mean to follow Jesus? When you're thinking through, should I do this a particular reproductive technology? Is it right or not? Or what should I do when the doctor's asking me what the do not resuscitate sort of wishes I would have for my mom who's sick in the hospital. All of those sorts of questions we equip churches and Christians to deal with. And then secondly, to speak from the churches to the outside world. Mm-hmm. So I deal a lot with media, with government officials, both in the United States and around the world, and with people who are involved in various kinds of culture, so in the technology sector or in other places. So I deal a lot with unbelievers, sometimes who have never really talked to a Christian before.
Mm-hmm. It's probably pretty exciting to get to do that.
It is, yeah, it is. And I found that most people actually are pretty receptive to hearing. And sometimes it's almost for people who've been in a situation where they've just never been around religious people, period, much yeah. less evangelical Christians. Sometimes it ends up being a lot of sort of like Nicodemus nighttime under cover of darkness conversations of just, hey, this is something I've always wondered. Those sorts of things happen a lot.
What sorts of questions do they ask you when they come in those situations?
Well, sometimes it will be things like, I've always wondered, is it true that you all believe something as crazy as fill in the blank, whatever it is. Sometimes it will be things like, I remember one situation particularly where someone said, I've sort of built my whole life around my career and I'm losing my job tomorrow. What would you say to someone like me?
Wow.
So those sorts of conversations happen a lot.
Wow.
Too, where, you know, people know that they're not going to be quoted or, you know, they're not going to be, then they sort of have the freedom to kind of show a little bit of vulnerability to say, hey, I don't really know how to think about this. Doesn't necessarily mean that they'll agree with what I have to say, but I found a lot of openness there.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Well, you also write, and I just saw yesterday that your book for that you just published, The Stormtoss Family, won Christianity Today's Book of the Year.
Yeah, we were really surprised. Yeah.
That is very exciting. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about that book.
This book is one of the things I noticed was I was talking to a friend of mine one time who said, you know, I knew that parenting would be humbling. I just never expected it would be this humiliating. And said it, I thought, you know what? I think I know exactly what you're talking about. And the more that I thought about it, the more I realized ultimately, really, any kind of family relationship is going to be humiliating because it's not one of those things that we can, in other areas of our life, sometimes we can have at least this illusion of control. But with family, you really can't. And it really doesn't matter what sort of family relationship you're dealing with, whether it's, you know, a single college student who's trying to think through, how do I relate to mom and dad? Or how do I deal with a family situation that is starting to seem crazy to me? Or somebody who's married and they're trying to relate to a spouse, or people who have children, whether they're at home or whether they're grown. Eventually, one of the things that family relationships do is to sort of puncture our tendency to make the people around us sort of extensions of what we want to think about ourselves.
Mm.
I noticed that about myself with, you know, one time when our oldest two sons were very small, they were toddlers, and we were in a Walmart and walking down the aisle. Both of them were very special needs, one on the autism spectrum, one a different set of special needs. And one of them was throwing a fit in the middle of the Walmart. And I noticed myself first looking around to see if there was anyone in the store who knew us. I thought, wait a minute, why did I do that? And there were all of these motivations that were sort of self-protective motivations. Like, I didn't want people to think I was a bad parent. I didn't want people to judge adopted kids. I didn't want all of these things that really weren't about what I should have been doing. Mm-hmm. And I've noticed that tendency in myself in multiple ways. And I've noticed it a lot with people that I'm working with and talking to. And so this book really is just about the fact that you're in a family crisis, whether you know it or not, mm-hmm. really at every step along the way. And the Bible speaks really honestly about that in a way that can pull us away both from this sort of idealized, I have to have a perfect family situation, or from this sense of I'm going to protect myself by running away from family. And the two tend to go together because, you know, there was a report that came out, I guess about a month ago, that was kind of good news, bad news. So the good news is the divorce rate is going down. The bad news is the divorce rate is going down because the marriage rate is going down and cohabitation is up. Well, what I've noticed when I talk to people who are living together and who aren't getting married, I think probably the Christian stereotype would be, well, these are people who don't really have a high view of marriage. I found that's not the case, is that they have too high a view of marriage. And so it's people who will say, I just don't want to go through divorce. I've been through that with my own parents. I don't want anybody else to go through that. And I want to make sure that when I get married, that this person is the right one, is the soulmate who's going to meet my expectations. I'm going to meet this person's expectations. And so they're pushing that marriage off because they think of marriage as this big capstone of life that's going to solve everything. And that's what leads to disappointment. I mean, it's the same thing with kids or with dealing with grown parents or anything else. If you've got this idealized vision of them in your mind, they're not going to live up to it. And that actually keeps you from loving the people who really are right there in front of you.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I've just started the book and I love how you draw the line of family to include everyone in the church. It's not just if you're married and you have children, everyone is brother or sister in the kingdom of God. And that's really, I appreciate that a lot. So I would love to talk about your role some more, because the way I see your role and what you do is that you have a very prophetic voice. You're kind of what you described earlier. You're standing on a line between two groups of people. And you're turning and speaking to each group of people. In both groups, sometimes don't want to hear what you have to say, right? You're trying to challenge them to think in ways that maybe will move them out of their comfort zones. And so I see you as having a prophetic voice. Do you think that prophecy is one of your gifts?
Well, I think it would depend on how people would speak of prophecy.
Yeah.
What people often mean when they think of prophecy is sort of the ability to communicate direct revelation from God. You know, sort of this is thus saith the Lord.
Yeah.
Things that we see in the prophets of the Bible in that case. No. In the case of what I think the sort of central calling of the prophetic task is, which is what God says to Jeremiah, to speak the word and to build up and to tear down with the word of God, then I think that's a calling for every Christian. And the reason I think that is because, at the very end of the Old Testament, the book of Malachi, God says, I'm going to send Elijah to you before the day of the Lord. And in the New Testament, so some of Jesus' disciples are wondering, well, when is this going to happen? And Jesus says it has, that the spirit of Elijah was there in John the Baptist. And he says something really interesting. He says, John is the greatest of all the prophets until now, but the least in the kingdom of God will be greater than he. So the task that John the Baptist has is one that I think every Christian has, which is to do two things. It's to say, repent, to sort of show the deficiencies that we all have, but not to stop them. To say, behold the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. So in that sense, I think that all of us have that task. And one of the things I think that complicates that is that there's sort of a natural human tendency to want to just belong to a herd and to go wherever that herd goes.
Yeah.
And we see that just sort of all around us right now, which means that that what we want to do is to sort of minimize whatever is happening internally to whatever your tribe is, and to maximize whatever is deficient that's taking place outside of your tribe. Which what I found is that Jesus does the exact opposite. So Jesus is speaking very, very gently with people who are on the outside, the people of God, and who are sort of weighted down with guilt and shame, you know. And he speaks very gently with them. He still speaks in a way that is provocative, but it's a different kind of provocation. And then he speaks very, very directly, and some would say harshly, with those who are either real or perceived within the people of God. I think that's what the Bible calls us to, which is just really difficult to do for any Christian, because you know everybody basically has the same job that I have at some level or another, because we live in a social media world where people are being pulled to sort of give their viewpoint on whatever. And the tendency is going to be to, well, if there are things that are going on among my kind of people, I'm not going to talk about those things, or I'm going to find a way to sort of adjust my faith to fit that. And then whatever's happening on the outside, I'm gonna denounce. You know, so it's Jesus is just counterintuitive in the way he comes in and upends all that.
So as you have stepped into this role, you've been in it 5 years now. Mm-hmm. What are some of the challenges that you faced in this unique position that you have? We all, as Christians, you're saying, are doing this, but you're doing it very publicly and vocally. So what are some of the challenges you faced?
Well, one of the challenges is that often the most dangerous things to people are not the things that they recognize. As a matter of fact, almost always that's the case. And so the temptation in this job would be to say, well, what are people debating and arguing about on Facebook right now? And you know, we'll come in and say, well, here are the Christian answers to those things. And really, the temptation would be just to sort of find out where people are already and then just kind of be one of their weapons that they use. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people do that. But I think that the most dangerous things for people are not the things that they're debating on Facebook right now at all. They're the things that they don't recognize, either because they sort of already accommodated to those things, or because they're just far enough in front of them that it sounds crazy to even talk about them. Mm. So if you think about pornography, for instance, I mean, every church, every family right now is dealing with the just ubiquitous nature of pornography, and in almost every sort of marriage problem I'm dealing with, that's right in the mix of it.
Yeah.
And in every congregation, this is sort of just tearing through. Well, you know, there was a time in the, you know, 90s when people thought we're really getting a hold of the pornography issue, because they were boycotting, you know, gas stations that sold magazines. Those, what they didn't recognize was that there's digital technology coming that was going to not only make pornography easily accessible, but it also was going to remove that thing that was preventing a lot of people from being drawn into it and enslaved by it, which is the sense of, I don't want to be the kind of person who thinks of myself as a consumer of pornography. So a lot of people didn't get caught up in that world because they just never would have walked into a strip club and looked somebody into the eye. Well, this technology was able to come in and say, okay, we can bypass that function where this can happen to you in a way that you think you're invulnerable to right now. And I mean, if you'd gone back and tried to explain, I mean, the number one question that I get from parents right now is about technology. And so it's, what do I do about iPhones, smartphones? Yesterday, I had a question, what do I do about Call of Duty, video game? If we put it on the teen setting, is that, you know, those sorts of questions would have sounded, you know, like a science fiction scenario just a few years ago.
Yeah.
We're on the precipice right now of technological advances that are going to make those things look like child's play. But if you stand up and say, hey, we really need to have a conversation about artificial intelligence and augmented reality and designer babies and cyborg humanity, those sorts of things, it sounds like, you know, science fiction sort of speculation, when it's not. It's right there. It's right there in front of you.
Well, I also am thinking, we're spending a season on my podcast talking about serving. And I think one of the things that I've learned in ministry and serving and taking leadership of things is that you're always going to face criticism of some sort, dealing with people's constructive criticism sometimes feedback that is not helpful. And I would love to hear from you and for everyone listening to learn from you how you've learned to navigate criticism well. What are some of the lessons that we need to know about how we can handle criticism as we're serving?
Well, I think, you know, I was noticing a few weeks ago, I picked up a Bible that I had not used in a long time. I mean, not that I hadn't used the Bible, I used different
kinds. Right.
But I picked up this old Bible that I had used back when I was serving this one particular church, and I happened to open it up, and there was an anonymous note that was put in the offering plate, directed to me, that was complaining about the fact that while I was preaching, I was looking at one side of the auditorium more than I was looking at the other side. And I laughed because I immediately remembered that. And then I started flipping through it, and I found all of these notes of encouragement that were, you know, I didn't remember any of those. And so I was like, that really is telling about me, that I will remember this 10 years later or more. I don't know how long ago it was, but I don't remember any of these other things. And that's a character defect that I have, but I'm able to recognize that and to know that that's there. I think when it comes to criticism, one of the things that any Christian has to know is that it is impossible to avoid criticism. Well, it's possible, but the way it's possible is to do nothing, say nothing, and simply go along with whatever flow you happen to be in at the moment, and then just change who you are depending upon your environment. Even then, it's really difficult to do, but some people try it. And so I think what you have to do is to have a sense of who you are and have a sense of what your calling is in order to be able to say what the Apostle Paul said in 1 Corinthians 3 and 4, when he says, it is a very small thing to be judged by you. And why? Because he says, I'm ultimately going to be judged at the judgment seat of Christ. Mm-hmm. And so to have a sense of I am in a fear of giving an account, not to whatever popular opinion is right now, but to the judgment seat of Christ. Because the reality of it is, no matter where you are, if you're trying to please public opinion, it's not going to work. Because you've got you've got sort of multiple constituencies happening at one time where you have not only the community, whatever community you're in right now, but you also have the community that is yet to come. So think about what Paul's doing in Galatians 1 and 2, where he says you have all of this pressure from these very powerful false teachers within the church at Galatia. And Paul says, I didn't yield to them for a minute. Why? So that the gospel would be preserved for you. So that if you don't deal with that, you're not going to be able to deal with the people who are yet to come. So, you know, there were a lot of pastors and leaders who during the era of Jim Crow were able to say, if I really speak to this, I'm not going to be able to lead my people. A lot of them, you can go back and just look at the way that a lot of people would justify to themselves their silence. And what they would say is, well, you know, I really have to sort of meet my people where they are, and I won't be able to serve them if my leadership position is jeopardized. But what they did was to say, in order to serve these people, I'm going to be unable to serve the people who will be here 10 years from now, because they're going to know, you know, when it comes down to it, you're not really speaking the word from God. You're really scared of people. So, I mean, think about it. Right now, one of the things that people are terrified of is the sexuality discussions. And scared in more than one way. One of the things that I've noticed is you will have, on the one hand, people who are just terrified if they say what the Bible teaches about sexuality, for fear that people are going to say you're a bigot, you're closed-minded, and so they don't talk about it, or they sort of just get really quiet about it, and they say to themselves, that's so that I can reach people. Or people who are really terrified of loving, developing friendships with people who disagree, or you know, for fear of what Jesus encountered with your eating with tax collectors.
Yeah.
And so they don't address the issues of saying, hey, mom and dad, don't kick your lesbian daughter out of the house, because they're afraid if they even address that people are going to say, oh, well, you're not speaking harshly enough about this. So you have those pressures of fear. What I found is if you just tell the truth as you see it to people, you're going to have a lot of blowback in whatever direction. Just make sure that the criticism that you're receiving is in stereo, as it was for Jesus. So if you're only getting criticism because you love tax collectors and sinners and eat with them, then maybe you say, are people confused about what I think about the call to repentance? And if you're only getting criticism because you are standing for the truth, but not for the fact that, oh, well, we think you might be a squish because you love people, then you have to say, well, why am I not getting that criticism? So eventually, I think the issue is not whether or not you get criticism. The issue is, are you getting enough of it? So, for instance, one time we were having an event that had to do with racial reconciliation and justice. And someone said, we were in the planning phase, and they said, what's your biggest fear of this? And I said, my biggest fear about this is that we won't get any backlash. And I said, which means if we don't get any backlash, it means that people don't know what we're talking about. And that's then we're not going to be able to help them. Because if somebody thinks, oh, well, you're only talking about the neo-Nazis down the street, not talking about the situation that's present in my neighborhood or in my heart, or my, then we're not going to be actually be able to address that. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes you have to say, is that the case? And then I think when it comes to giving criticism, a lot of that has to do with saying, what is the nature of the relationship that I have with this person? So that's going to calibrate how I criticize that person, and what's holding that person back? Because that's what I think you see happening in both the Old and New Testaments. You have Nathan, who comes to David in David's immorality with Bathsheba, and Nathan knows, he's wise enough to know that he can't come up and say, David, you're committing adultery. Look at Exodus 20. There's going to be a protective barrier there. So he comes in and he tells the story of a man who takes his neighbor's ewe lamb, and he gets that imaginative, sympathetic response from David, and then he goes around those defenses to get to him. Jesus does the same thing. And so Jesus is doing that sometimes by coming in and just sort of gently, woman, where is your husband? John 4. Sometimes by dropping the hammer and saying, like he did in his hometown synagogue, God's working outside the borders of people. So you have to sort of know, who am I dealing with? What's the issue here? And sometimes that can be difficult because you're dealing with different kinds of people, where you have, for instance, you think about the difference between the way that the Apostle Paul deals with Timothy, just sort of gently leading him as a father to a son, the way he deals with Simon Peter in Galatians 2, rebukes him to his face, but he counts him as a brother. Mm-hmm. And then the way he deals with the false teachers, where he says, these are not people who are of Christ, and speaks very, very directly. If you mix those up, then you're going to end up in a situation where people are going to be harmed. And sometimes that's easy to discern, and sometimes it's not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Dr. Moore, one of the mistakes I think, or maybe misunderstandings that I had coming into ministry when I was younger, is that if I wasn't getting positive feedback or appreciation, that I was maybe not on the right track, that I should, if I'm serving the Lord faithfully, that I should be appreciated for that or noticed for that. And that's not always the case. A lot of times when we're moving along on track, there can be silence. It can sometimes feel like, is everything going okay? I'm not quite sure. So I'd love to know from you how you know that you are on the right track. How do you know that you're being faithful to fulfill the calling God has placed on your life?
Well, you're right about that in the sense that that is what happens to a lot of people. And I think there are several reasons for that. And one of those reasons is a lot of time, not all the time, of course, but a lot of times when you're dealing with criticism, for most people who are serving in ministry, a very small amount of that is constructive criticism. I want to make this better.
Yeah.
Usually a lot of it that you're dealing with are from wounded people who would be angry about something else if they weren't angry about this. And a lot of what, a lot of sometimes the most hostile people that you're dealing with in ministry are really saying to you is, please pay attention to me. So you have to filter all that, you know, to determine that. The other thing is, the people who actually are benefiting from whatever it is that you're doing, because they're not sort of enacting that drama that is coming from people who are critical, they just assume, well, I'm benefiting from Christine's ministry. Of course, Everybody knows that. Everybody's benefiting from it. She knows that. And so they're not motivated to sort of encourage you because they just assume, well, of course you know that. You're Christine Hoover. You're awesome. You know that. And so they don't do that. And I think seeing that over the years has really sort of made me start to take notice of how often is that the case for me, where there are people that I really benefit from, but I don't ever say anything about it because it sounds obvious,
right?
When you do it. So I think that's part of it. But the other part is, so I think that's what's kind of going on with Elijah when he's out in the wilderness and he says, I and only I am left. And God says, no, there are 7,000 right. out there. You're really not all by yourself, even though you think that you are. So I think the way that you determine it is, first of all, by having a conscience and a heart that is shaped and directed by the Word of God, so that you're able to recognize things in yourself and in others. And then to have around you a group of people where you say, it really matters to me what these people think, because I know that they know me, and I know that they know the Lord, and that they walk closely with the Lord, and that they have an understanding of the Word of God, and they're wise people who are able to read the situation around them. And so you need people like that to be able to say, I have people in my life where I'm able to say, hey, am I crazy?
Yeah.
I lay out whatever the situation is, whether that's in ministry or in parenting or in whatever it is. And I have the kind of people in my life who will sometimes say, yeah, you're crazy. You're overreacting to that. You're not seeing that right. And who sometimes will say, no, actually, you're seeing this the right way. But to have the people who you say, if these people are telling me that I'm on the wrong track, that doesn't necessarily mean I am, because there are times when one must stand completely alone for Christ and His Word. But it gives me a better indication that I really need to reconsider and to rethink this. And it also means, I think, that you're going to have a different level of sort of, there are going to be some things that I don't know enough about that I'm really going to listen to some people who do. There are going to be other things, though, where I know I actually know more about this than the people who don't understand what it is that I'm talking about. You have to kind of know those different areas of competence in order to move forward.
Mm-hmm. That's helpful. Well, I think also one of the challenges that I'm seeing around me and in for people who are in vocational ministry, especially, but this could apply to really anybody. And I'm in middle age, and people that we've been in ministry alongside of for 20 years now, and we're seeing people leaving their ministry roles and just they can't do it anymore, and they leave, and for various reasons. But one of the things that I've really been thinking about is, how can I make it to the end, not just ministry, but make it to the end of life living faithfully to the Lord? So what have you learned about endurance and perseverance in ministry?
Part of it is watching people over the course of a life. And I think that having models is really important, both in terms of positive and negative models. I mean, the scripture gives us that constantly. I mean, the Proverbs is saying, watch this wise person, but also watch the fool.
Yeah.
Or watch the person who grabs a dog by the ears, those sorts of models. And I think that watching and just saying, why does someone get in the situation and how does it ultimately end? So I'm just like you, seeing a lot of people. I mean, every day, as recently as this morning, dealing with people that I sort of started out ministry with, who end up either sort of morally sabotaging themselves, or just getting dispirited and discouraged and just giving up.
Yeah.
Or who make it to the end, but who make it to the end bitter and resentful and all those things. And so then when you see somebody that you're able to say, this is sort of the way I would want to die, ultimately. Spending some time thinking, well, what happened in this person's life? How did this person cultivate that? I think is really significant. And the other thing, though, is to say, there's this little book that I hand out to people in ministry all of the time, written by an unbeliever, called The Dip, by Seth Godin. A leadership marketing sort of guru, but he's paid attention to how ideas work. And what he says is, you're going to, if you're doing anything that is of actual value, is bringing a contribution, then that means that you're going to be disrupting a status quo. Whether that's, you know, you're Steve Jobs inventing stuff, or, you know, you're trying to change the way you do small group ministry, or, you know, whatever, you're going to encounter resistance once the status quo starts to see this is going to change. And so there's going to be this dip where things are going to seem like they're just impossible. It's not working. And he said, what happens is most people just quit at that point. But he said, but if you'll notice, the people who actually succeed are the people who go through the dip on over into the other side. And so you look at people now, and then you say, you kind of look at people at the end stage, and you say, well, this is the way it's always been. I mean, Billy Graham. You know, everyone loves Billy Graham. Look at Billy Graham. That Billy Graham was just absolutely vilified from all sorts of corners when he was in the prime of his ministry because he was doing something different. If he had just quit, I mean, we wouldn't have benefited ultimately from Billy Graham. And so I think there's a lot to that. What you have to do is to make the distinction between what's a cul-de-sac, that really I really am in an area that I can't serve the Lord in because I'm not gifted to serve the Lord, or where am I just facing that sense of resistance that I need to press through in order to get to fruitfulness on the other side. So I had a pastor that I love very much who called me one time and he said, I'm wanting to leave my church. And it was because he went into a church that was really sort of ingrown in the way that it was doing things. And he came in, he was changing things. They were actually reaching the community. And there was a group of people who didn't like that in the congregation. So he was just getting a lot of kind of guerrilla warfare going on in the congregation. And he said, so I want to leave. And I said, well, now, wait a minute. I said, how many people in this congregation would you say are sort of opposed to you? He said, probably 10%. And I said, well, where are the 90%? And he said, well, they're, you know, the people who are with us are just great. They're really supportive and whatever. I said, so why would you just abandon them and take all the time that you have put into building what you've been building here to go start all over again, where you're still going to have 10% of the congregation who are going to be against, no matter where you are, at least 10% of the people, or at some point or other, are going to be after you. So why would you just start all over again? Because what he was tending to think was, well, if I can just get out of here, then I'm going to be a place where I just have just unimpeded freedom to go, well, you're not going to have that in anything that you're doing that's worth yeah. doing. And so I think keeping that in mind is really important.
Yeah, that's really good. What about for those people who are serving faithfully, but they're just depleted and they feel like they've given and given and they're not sure they have much to give? How would you encourage them to kind of reorient themselves again around God's call on their lives?
Well, see, this is where I made some big mistakes, and where I've seen a lot of people make big mistakes, which is, you know, when I mentioned that earlier about kind of seeing people that I started out with sort of orally blowing themselves up, usually in all of those situations, if you go back and you, in almost all of them, if you go back and you do kind of an autopsy on what happened, in almost every situation, what I found are people who were depleted, as you said, but who felt like they didn't have the freedom to be depleted because they had a ministry that was dependent upon them that had kind of taken on a life of its own in a way where they couldn't say, I'm depleted, without a lot of people who count on them being disappointed in their minds. And so what ended up happening was really kind of a ministry suicide, where people were looking for some way to either anesthetize or to find a kind of escape from the responsibilities of ministry, either through substances or through immoral behavior, whatever it was. And I, you know, that's a really scary sort of end point. And what I noticed in my own life is that I would find myself in times when I was exhausted, I was depleted, I was not seeing things correctly, I was discouraged, but the mentality was, there's no way for me to stop doing things as I'm doing them.
Mm-hmm.
I needed and had a couple of older ministry leaders that I really respect, who were able to come in and say, here's what you need to do in order to have long-term faithfulness to God. And for me, because it's easier to see what's going on in other people's lives, just because you're objective, than it is to seeing what's going on in your own life. But to have people come in and say, no, this is what you need to do. So for me, for instance, one of the problems that I was having and sometimes still do is not because of all of the sort of frenetic activity that happens, not having time to think, reflect, pray, you know, all of those sorts of things. And so I needed to say, okay, how do I do that? And you know, that means knowing yourself. So, I mean, we have on our team here, we have some people who are extreme extroverts, who for them, you know, the way that they would really thrive is having fellowships going on with people, you know, all night long, every night. I'm an introvert, which means, you know, I can do all the things that I need to do. But in order to do that, I've got to have sustained time of thinking, preparation, and so forth alone.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I've got other people here. It's just the reverse. They've got to spend some time alone, but they've got to work themselves up for that with all the. So you have to know that about yourself and to say, okay, how do I then build that in? And one of the things you're going to find out is you're going to end up disappointing people.
Yeah.
And so you're going to disappoint people. And so what I've decided is I've got a lot of people who just kind of want me with them all the time for whatever reason or other, and I can't do that. Or a lot of people who actually mean a lot to me, who would like me to do this, this, and this that they want to do, that I say, you know what, it's actually in everybody's better interest if I don't do that. And what is, how can I best serve long-term? And that's going to mean saying no to a lot of things. And it's going to be saying, how do I actually get charged up? One thing I noticed, just with me, and this would be different for other people, but I noticed I was complaining to this older person. I said, you know, I just feel like I've lost my mojo. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, there are times in my life when I just have tons of ideas just coming all over the place. And right now I don't. But what I've noticed is right now I have more mojo and creativity when it comes to planning, content, everything else than I do. And if, every year that's the case in December. And I said, why is that the case in December? Well, it's because I'm not traveling as much. And, you know, things kind of slow down to a certain degree where I actually have the time to reflect and to think and to plan. Well, that ought to then sort of inform the way that the rest of the year goes. And so I think that for people who are in ministry, a lot of that is dependent upon saying, okay, what has God gifted me uniquely to be able to do? You know, there are things you can do, but things that for you would actually siphon away from sort of those two or three things that centrally are the things that God has called you to do. And so for me, you know, I had to say at one point, you know, I could travel around being denominational politician, doing ribbon cuttings and being in every meeting that I could possibly do in. That's not really what God's gifted me to do. And it would take away from things that God has gifted. In the same way that there are other people that if they were spending time, and I've known people like this who think, well, I need to write books and I need to write articles. And I think, you know what? You're really wasting a lot of time trying to write stuff because you think that you ought to, when instead God has really gifted you to be convener of people or gifted you to be, you know, any number of things that evangelist, disciple, those sorts of things. And so to know that and to say, well, then how does that, how does that fit with what God has called me to do? I think sometimes it's hard to figure that out. You need people in your life who know you and who've known you for a long time to tell you that. And then sometimes it is by saying to yourself, "What makes me miserable?"
That's a good question.
Not what do I not like to do? Because we all have things we don't like to do. But there are going to be things where you say, This makes me miserable to do this. It still means you might need to do it.
Right.
But it might be a sign that's not where the central thrust of what it is that God is doing for you is. And that's sometimes, I think, difficult because I think when we're younger, we assume, just like we do when we're kids, the grown-ups know what's going on. And so we're going to pretend to be grown up, and we're going to know when we get there, we're going to know what's going on. But right now, we trust them to know. Yeah. Eventually, you get to the point where you realize, wait a minute. Not only am I not actually grown up that way, nobody is. and that's a terrifying moment when you finally do get to the point where you realize that. But you also say, okay, well, then what does that mean? It means that sometimes just sort of looking at the models that I have in my life and saying everything that person is doing right now is what I need to be doing, is going to lead to is going to lead to frustration.
Yeah.
So I came into a job that I used to have at Southern Seminary. I followed a leader that I really respected and respect, Danny Aiken. And so I came in, and at first I was thinking, I can't do this because I can't do all of these things that Danny Aiken is gifted and able to do. And someone very wisely said, you're going to fail being Danny Aiken. And everybody's going to just keep saying, boy, Danny Aiken, we so much rather have Danny Aiken than Deutero Danny Aiken here. To come in and say, well, how has God gifted me? Shore up those other areas and plunge into those areas. And so then what you're going to notice is for a little bit, you're going to have people saying, why aren't you doing fill in the blank like so-and-so used to do? But eventually that's going to become the norm.
Yeah.
And then the next guy that comes in, people are going to say, well, why don't you do what Russell Moore did with whatever? And that's exactly right. And I've noticed that just in so many different ministries, and whether it's, you know, people who are leading an evangelism ministry or Sunday school or whatever it is, you just have to kind of start to know that about yourself. And sometimes that's going to be, usually that's going to be a lot of trial and error.
Yeah.
Now, okay, this isn't working. And that's kind of what I'm going through right now, because in the ministry I'm in right now, we had to spend 4 years completely rebuilding an institution.
Right.
In most of the people that God was calling us to equip in order to carry Christian ministry to the future didn't know in 2013 what our institution was.
Right.
And the ones who did hated it. And so we had to spend a lot of time. So there was a lot of frenetic activity that had to happen there. And then I have to come back and say, okay, now, but that's not that same level of frenetic activity in all of these areas.
Right.
Can't continue that way. Yeah. We've got to say, let's focus here and focus here and focus mm-hmm. here. I think everybody really has to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. I love how you keep bringing in other people, talking about mentors and looking at examples and having friends who can kind of help. Because it's so hard to see these things in ourselves or to know what our own gifts are, but for other people who are around us, to be able to talk to them and to follow their examples, so important. I love that you keep bringing that up. And I just have one more question just to end. I would love to know from your vantage point, because you do get to see so much of what's happening around the nation and in the world. I'd love to know what you're encouraged about that God is doing in, I would say, American evangelicalism in particular.
Well, I'm really encouraged because I'm dealing with a lot of very young Christians a lot, and very young not yet Christians a lot too. And what I'm seeing is that God is doing a very new thing. Now, every age is going to have its. He's going to have its unique problems and situations. But I've noticed that younger Christians are accustomed to being distinctive and having to sort of not assuming that they're Christians. So, you know, if you go onto your typical secular college campus, you're going to have Christians who are committed, Christians who know what Christianity is about, and you're going to have pagans.
Mm-hmm.
What you're not going to have is that really, really dangerous middle category of paganized people who feel like they ought to pretend to be Christians.
Yeah,
that's not going to be there. And so I think that's really encouraging in terms of the ultimate witness of the church. And so when I hear people, sometimes you'll hear people lamenting millennials and Generation Z. And I mean, I just saw a video that was going viral the other day about how millennials and post-millennials are entitled and selfish, and all they want is beanbags and free food and whatever. I just am not seeing that, yeah. at least among Christians. I'm seeing, in many ways, a better situation than what we have seen in American Christianity in a long, long, long time.
That's very encouraging. Well, speaking of benefiting from someone's ministry, I would say I have benefited greatly from your ministry and from all the work that you're doing at the ERLC. And just as an example of how you're doing what you're doing is an example to me and to my husband. So I'm really thankful for you and thankful for your time today.
Well, thank you, and you as well. Thanks for having me.
Friends, thank you so much for listening to My Faith. Join me next week as I speak with my friend Melissa Krueger. You heard about her book at the beginning of the show. We're going to talk about the gift of teaching. We chat about how she's cultivated her own gift of teaching and how she's helping other women learn to teach the Bible. I love how Melissa says, we are all teachers in some way because we're all called as Christians to do what Jesus said, go and teach all that I've commanded you. We also talk about the insecurities and discouragement that she's faced as a teacher and what she's learned through those very things. Melissa's joy and enthusiasm is pretty contagious, so I know you're going to love our conversation. Until then, friends, have a great week and keep walking forward by faith.